Welcome to the Deep Dive. I mean, if you are joining us today, you are probably looking for the latest insights on the commercial real estate market.
Right. You want to know where the cap rates are settling.
Exactly. What the debt markets are doing, where the smart money is moving. We do have a set of source notes today that covers all of that. But, well, not in the way you might expect.
No, not at all.
Our mission today is to review the latest field reports from Priyanshu, Pri Adithakar. He is a commercial real estate and hotel investment advisor. But to really understand his notes on the current state of the market, you have to completely shift your perspective.
You really do. You have to stop looking at the industry as a functioning financial market.
Right.
And you have to start looking at it as a high security psychiatric ward.
It sounds extreme, but it is the only framework that actually explains the data right now.
Yeah, if you look at the macro environment, I mean, the math simply doesn't align with the behavior. So we're stepping into the roles of two weary clinical observers today. We are clocking in for another night shift at the nursing desk.
And the ward is exceptionally loud this evening.
Oh, you can hear them pacing the halls from here.
Mm.
The titans of the commercial real estate industry, you know, just shuffling around in backless gowns.
Clutching their spreadsheets like security blankets. It is genuinely exhausting to observe.
It's really wearying.
If you are listening to this, just pull up a chair to the desk with us. Look at the latest admission to the ward the chart just came across.
Ah, yes. Room 402.
Yeah. Room 402, a prominent regional syndicator. You look at the financial vitals, and on paper, the IRR, the internal rate of return, is perfectly healthy.
Robust, even. I mean, they are hitting their promotes.
Right. But then you look at the patient's EKG, their actual quality of life, their baseline humanness, and it is flatlining. It is just a straight, uninterrupted tone.
It is a classic presentation. The patient is suffering from a highly virulent strain of desire-induced unhappiness.
Okay, unpack that term for us.
Well, it is a condition first cataloged by Naval Revicant, but it has mutated beautifully in the humid, ego-driven environment of commercial real estate. What Naval pointed out is that desire is essentially a contract you make with yourself.
A contract to be unhappy.
Exactly. To be unhappy until you get what you want. And in CRE, that timeline is stretched out over years of complex, highly leveraged misery.
It is this bizarre psychological contract the investor signs. They agree completely voluntarily to be utterly miserable, high-strung, and, well, cognitively impaired until a specific closing or liquidity event occurs.
Yeah. That is the admission criterion for this ward.
And we are reviewing the only diagnostic notes that matter tonight. Pry is acting as the lead investigator here.
He is the sole reporter walking these halls who can actually spot the industry's cognitive decline.
Because everyone else out in the market, like the brokers, the lenders, the institutional equity, they are just blindly polishing their pro formas.
Just whistling past the graveyard. Pry is the one taking the actual pulse. He is performing the autopsy on the deals that look alive on paper, but are completely dead in reality.
Okay, well, let's unpack this fresh disaster. Before we look at the specific asset classes ravaging their brains, we really have to understand the underlying disease, the pathology.
Right.
Because if you are listening to this and you have ever found yourself staring at a cash flow model at 2 a.m. on a Sunday, just sweating over a 20 basis point shift in interest rates,
you might already be infected.
You most likely are. What Pri has isolated in the lab is a condition we are calling CMAID, chronic multi-asset acquisition disorder.
It is a systemic infection. Mm-hmm. To understand it, you have to clinically deconstruct the psychological contract these patients are signing. It is highly predatory.
And the tragedy is that it is an internal agreement.
Yeah, they are the predator and the prey. Let's look at the financial mechanics of this internal loan they take out on their own sanity.
I have the terms of the contract right here. It reads like a horror story. Let's start with section one, which is the collateral.
Okay.
In a normal, rational world, collateral is hard asset, a physical building, cash in the bank. In CMAD, the collateral is the investor's current peace of mind.
Oh, absolutely. It is their presence at their kid's soccer game.
Yes, it is their physical health. That is what they're putting up against the loan to secure the next deal.
And the cost of capital is exorbitant. Let's look at section two, the interest rate.
It is an SOFR plus 200 basis points, is it?
No, the interest rate is 100% of their attention, compounded daily. When you underwrite a property, the physical structure requires maintenance, sure. But this psychological contract demands constant obsessive servicing.
Wow.
Every time the 10-year treasury yield ticks up a fraction of a percent, the interest payment on their attention comes due.
It just consumes the host entirely. It is essentially parasitic.
Yeah.
But it is section three that really traps them. the maturity date.
Right, because in a standard dead vehicle, you have a balloon payment, a known end date.
But in this contract, the maturity date is constantly, endlessly deferred. It is always just one deal away.
Exactly. The next deal is no longer a strategic business milestone. It is a temporary, fleeting cure for a completely self-inflicted malaise. They genuinely believe the next acquisition will finally pay off the psychological debt.
It is like watching an addict sign a contract to run on a treadmill that is permanently set to a dead sprint. They are completely convinced that the mirage of a finish line will somehow cure their utter exhaustion.
But the finish line keeps moving.
Always. As Priya notes in the patient's chart, this trend is escalating across the major firms. The next deal isn't an investment strategy anymore. It is a desperate gasp for oxygen.
So now that we understand the predatory nature of the contract, we have to document exactly how this disease rots the executive functioning of senior partners and investment committees.
Because this isn't just about feeling stressed out.
No, not at all. This pathology physically alters how these professionals underwrite risk. You see it during the clinical rounds. The cognitive decline is staggering, and it presents in very specific, financially destructive symptoms.
Let's go through the chart. The first major symptom we are tracking on the war tonight is exit cap fixation.
This is a hallucinatory state. Walk past room 410, and you will see a patient sitting in a chair, just entirely detached from reality. They believe their present worth and their firm's stability are tied entirely to a theoretical disposition in the year 2029.
And because they are hyper-focused on this future cure, the exit, they lose all grasp of present moment operational reality.
Right.
Give us the actual mechanics of that. I mean, how does that hallucination bankrupt a portfolio today?
Because they will completely ignore a literal physical water leak or a spike in utility costs in their current operations. Their eyes are glazed over. They are staring at a projected terminal cap rate 5 years from now.
Just ignoring the flooding basement.
Exactly. They underwrite a 5-year hold with an assumption that they can exit at a 5 cap. When the market shifts and that exit cap looks more like a 7, their brain just refuses to process the new data.
So instead of aggressively cutting operational bloat today to preserve the yield,
they just hold on to the delusion that the market will magically compress cap rates right before they sell. They are bleeding cash in the present because they live in a fictional future.
It is a terminal case of projection. Let's move down the hall to symptom 2, multi-contract paralysis.
A healthy specimen might focus their cognitive load on one desire, you know, one specific asset class. They master retail or they master self-storage.
But not the patients in this ward.
No. They suffer from the neural overload of attempting to sign these toxic happiness contracts across multifamily, industrial, and hospitality all at exactly the same time. The brain simply cannot process that level of deferred happiness and risk management across so many distinct operational fronts.
But wait, let me push back on this. Because if you are listening, you might be thinking, isn't that just basic diversification? We are taught by every institutional allocator to spread risk. If office space dies, you want to be in industrial. Why is Precia diagnosing basic portfolio diversification as a cognitive disease?
That is a really critical distinction. True diversification is a defensive strategy executed by a well-capitalized institution with dedicated siloed teams. Multi-contract paralysis is an offensive, ego-driven compulsion executed by a small to mid-sized team that completely lacks the bandwidth. When a boutique firm tries to pivot from apartments into developing a luxury hotel simply because they saw a competitor do it, that isn't diversification. That is cross-asset delusion.
So the mechanics fail.
Exactly. The mechanical failure happens because the firm's underwriting muscle memory in multifamily completely misprices the operational intensity of hospitality. They freeze when the different asset classes require contradictory management styles.
Severe analysis paralysis sets in.
Yeah, and they end up deploying capital poorly across all three sectors instead of deploying it masterfully in one.
That makes total sense. They are diluting their expertise, not their risk. Which leads us to the most tragic symptom on the floor. AUM dysmorphia. Assets under management dysmorphia.
Oh, this is the one that fills the beds the fastest. The patient is sitting on massive, objectively impressive cash flow. They have a $75 million portfolio kicking off incredible stabilized yield. But they feel physically small. They feel inadequate.
Why?
Simply because they haven't hit $1 billion in assets yet. They have signed a contract to be unhappy until they reach an arbitrary rounded up number with two commas.
I have to play the voice of the enablers outside this hospital for a second. Isn't ambition just the baseline heart rate of this industry? You have to be deeply driven to survive in commercial real estate. How do you actually separate healthy, aggressive growth from this clinical dysmorphia?
The differential diagnosis is really simple. You look at the debt structure. Ambition produces calculated results. It produces stabilized assets, fixed rate debt, and long-term wealth preservation. AUM dysmorphia. That produces institutional amnesia.
Amnesia?
Yes. Specifically, it completely erases the memory of debt service cliffs from the prefrontal cortex.
How exactly? Walk us through the anatomy of that amnesia.
Well, a syndicator wants to cross the $1 billion threshold so badly that they lower their acquisition standards. To win the bid on a mediocre Class B property, they use high leverage, floating rate bridge debt.
Even though they know the property's current cash flow cannot support a spike in interest rates?
Right. But the dysmorphia whispers, just get the asset under management. We will figure out the rate caps later. Ambition is looking at the horizon and plotting a safe course. Dysmorphia is driving toward the cliff edge in a Ferrari because you care more about how the car looks than the fact you forgot to install brakes. Price boots on the ground diagnosis of this delusion is the only thing cutting through the noise right now. He sees these capital stacks, and he knows that the drive for a vanity metric is creating systemic insolvency.
The symptoms are undeniably clear, but the expression of the disease mutates depending on the specific asset class the patient is fixated on. The physical structure of the real estate actually dictates the structure of the psychosis. Let's walk the halls. If you look to the left, through the reinforced glass, we have the hotel wing.
Yes, the high acuity ward. If you are an investor heavily weighted in hospitality, listen closely. Hotels are not just real estate. Clinically, they are classified as a high-frequency emotional derivative.
Explain the mechanics of that. Why is a hotel more toxic to the nervous system than a warehouse?
Well, if a standard 10-year triple net lease on an industrial warehouse is a slow-burn contract, a hotel is an asset that mathematically and operationally resets every single night. Because the inventory, the hotel room, expires and resets daily at checkout, the patient is forced to sign a brand new, highly volatile unhappiness contract every single morning.
It is an agonizing way to live. Your entire net worth has to be resold every 24 hours. What are the specific pathologies presenting in the hotel wing?
Two primary ones. First, the TRevPAR trap. Total revenue per available room. You can hear the patients muttering it as they pace. They tie their daily emotional stability to a slight fluctuation in a transient, highly localized metric.
So they panic over daily rates.
Oh, they will literally lose sleep because a neighboring hotel dropped their nightly rate by $15, forcing them to either lose occupancy or compress their own margins.
And the second pathology?
PIP purgatory, property improvement plans. The patient genuinely believes they will find inner peace, but only after the lobby renovation is complete and the corporate brand inspector leaves the premises.
Let's drill into the financial mechanism of a PIP, because it's not just choosing new carpets, is it? It is a psychological hostage situation.
Exactly. A PIP is a mandated capital extraction. The hotel brand dictates that every 7 to 10 years, the owner must inject massive amounts of their own capital to update the property to brand standards. And that is regardless of whether the local market actually supports the higher room rates required to pay for it.
So the owner is trapped.
Completely trapped.
Yeah.
If they don't do the PIP, they lose the franchise flag, which destroys the asset's value. If they do the PIP, their cash flow is wiped out for 2 years. They suffer from micromanagement migraines, obsessing over the cost of bathroom fixtures while completely missing the macroeconomic cycle.
And a mere 0.5% dip in occupancy is processed by their diseased brain, not as a typical Tuesday in November, but as a deep personal moral failure.
Total operational blindness. They're studying a grain of sand while a tsunami approaches.
Okay, let's leave the hotel wing before the anxiety rubs off on us. Across the hall, we have the multifamily wing. It is noticeably quieter over here. The lighting is softer.
Deceptively quieter. These patients suffer from a completely different, almost silent mutation. We call it the passive delusion and its twin symptom, maintenance amnesia.
You hear this all the time on the outside. Housing is a basic human need, they tell themselves. People always need a place to live. Multifamily is a safe haven. It sounds incredibly comforting.
It is a powerful sedative. And like any sedative, it wears off violently. The financial mechanics of multifamily breed complacency. Because the leases are 12 months long, the revenue feels stable. They coast on this perceived stability, underwriting minimal capital reserves.
And then what happens?
They plummet almost instantly into clinical depression when a $500,000 roof replacement suddenly hits the ledger, or a municipality abruptly changes the rent control laws. The whiplash is violent because they convince themselves the asset was passive. Real estate is never passive. It is just slowly degrading.
It is a rigged game. Think about what we are observing here. Whether you are sweating the daily high-frequency volatility of a resort in the hotel wing, or you are hypnotized by the fake slow burn stability of an apartment complex in the multifamily wing, the underlying disease is identical.
Exactly identical.
You are actively, voluntarily placing your internal, fragile emotional state into the hands of a physical, inanimate structure. A building made of concrete, drywall, and PVC piping is dictating your serotonin levels.
It is complete madness. And that is exactly how Pri saw the symptoms before the family portfolio was traded away for so many of these patients. He recognized early on that the specific asset class doesn't matter. The psychological surrender of the investor is exactly the same.
So we have an entire industry acting out a shared, highly lucrative delusion. The wards are full, the interest rates are volatile, and the debt walls are approaching. What is the actual treatment plan? How does the solo authority on this disease perform the surgery to save a dying deal, or, more importantly, save the investor from themselves?
The intervention requires heavy reverse psychology. Priya prescribes a regimen deeply steeped in what he calls medical underwriting. This is not about tweaking the Excel spreadsheet to make the numbers look prettier for the LP investors.
Right. It is a psychological treatment.
It is about rewiring the sponsor's broken reward system so they stop acquiring toxic assets in the first place.
Okay. What is step one of the treatment plan? Because telling a CRE titan to stress less is like telling a shark to stop swimming.
Step one is contract renegotiation. The patient must immediately void the baseline happiness agreements they have made with themselves. You have to surgically shift the dopamine trigger.
Because right now, the trigger is at closing.
Yes. In the disease state, their brain only releases dopamine at the closing table when the wire hits and the deal is done. That is fatal because it incentivizes closing at any cost. You have to move that trigger away from the closing table and into the investment committee process itself.
Wait, how do you practically do that in the real world? How do you make the analysis more rewarding than the acquisition fee?
You structure the firm's compensation and culture around risk mitigation, not just transaction volume. You celebrate the deals you kill in committee just as hard as the ones you fund.
Oh, that is fascinating.
When the team finds a hidden structural flaw in a property during due diligence and walks away, that has to trigger the dopamine hit. The joy must be found in the discipline of the autopsy, not the manic high of the acquisition.
That is a brutal withdrawal process for an industry addicted to transaction fees. What is step two?
Selective asset specialization. We have to bring out the scalpel. We must amputate the shiny object appendages.
Explain the financial mechanics of this surgery.
If a firm is suffering from multi-contract paralysis, bleeding capital trying to manage three different asset classes poorly, they must forcefully liquidate the distraction assets. They focus entirely on one primary strategy.
Even if it means selling at a loss.
Yes, it hurts to sell a property at a slight loss. But you are buying back the cognitive bandwidth of the executive team. You drastically reduce the cognitive tax on the brain's executive function. You narrow the field of vision to restore operational clarity.
And when you only focus on industrial warehouses, you start seeing the matrix. You anticipate macro trends before they hit.
Exactly.
And step three, this is the one that really stings the ego, I imagine.
The post-closing placebo. This requires a clinical, brutal realization on the part of the patient. They must mathematically accept that the chemical high of closing a deal lasts for exactly 48 hours. 2 days.
Why 48 hours?
Because on day one, the press release goes out. On day two, the congratulatory emails roll in. On day three, the physical reality of the asset sets in.
Ah, the honeymoon is over.
The property management company calls about a broken boiler. The reality of the debt service payments crystallizes. The delta between the acquisition high and the operational reality is where the depression lives. The brain's baseline resets, and it begins frantically seeking a new contract, a new deal to chase the dragon.
So how do you use that awareness as a shield? Do you just stop buying?
No, you institutionalize a cooling off period. When you know the high is a 48-hour placebo, you write it into your firm's bylaws that you cannot formally bid on a new property for 60 days after a major close.
A mandated pause.
You prevent yourself from immediately signing a higher leverage, significantly more dangerous contract just to feel something again. You force the team to sit on their hands and actually operate the asset they just bought until the withdrawal passes.
So if you are listening to this, what does this all mean for your portfolio tomorrow morning? The cure isn't about finding a better IRR at all, is it? It's about realizing the magic beans aren't real. And finally, looking at the actual brain of the deal, the risk profile, the debt structure, the operational reality, instead of just staring at the inflated returns on page one of the pitch deck.
That is the absolute essence of Prize Medical Underwriting. You have to treat the portfolio manager, not just the portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
Because the person making the decisions is cognitively impaired by AUM dysmorphia. No amount of good real estate can save them from bad debt.
It's terrifying.
If you are waiting for your exit in 2029 to finally feel successful, to finally exhale and be present with your family, you are already insolvent in the currency of life.
Well, our shift at the nursing desk is coming to an end. The morning staff is arriving. It is time to deliver the final, brutal prognosis for you, the listener, before we hand over the keys to the ward.
The bottom line to survive this high-risk cognitive environment is simple to prescribe, but it is the hardest pill to swallow. Diversify your identity.
Just as you would diversify an equity fund to protect against localized volatility.
Exactly. You must diversify who you are outside of the market. If 90% of your internal self-worth is collateralized by your external net worth, you are exactly one minor market correction away from a total psychological foreclosure.
And as we close out this deep dive into Prize Field Notes, we are required by the CRE Clinic's Department of Psychological Underwriting to read the ward's safety protocols. Please listen carefully, as your compliance is mandatory.
Participation in this market and in this reality check constitutes your legal acknowledgement that commercial real estate is a high-risk cognitive environment.
Warning. Reading Prize Notes or listening to this deep dive may lead to an acute, painful awareness that your one-deal-away philosophy is a recurring, desperate hallucination. Please note that the chief of surgery is not responsible if you suddenly feel the urge to cancel a Sunday night underwriting session to actually speak to your children.
Or if you miraculously manage to eat a meal with your spouse without frantically checking the 10-year treasury yield under the table.
Please ensure your ego is securely stowed in an overhead bin before logging into your investor portal. High leverage desires are medically proven to cause structural instability in the prefrontal cortex,
leading to irrational exuberance, floating rate debt dependency, and portfolio-induced insomnia.
And finally, be warned of the severe side effects of Prize treatment plan. Common side effects include significantly lower blood pressure, strangely improved relationships with non-investors, and the highly dangerous, almost radical ability to look at a bad deal, even if it perfectly fits your arbitrary billion-dollar AUM goals, and simply say no.
We specialize in the removal of delusional underwriting here. Proceed back in the market at your own risk.
Definitely at your own risk.
And as you leave the ward tonight and step back out into that chaotic environment of recurring delusions, pro formas, and shifting cap rates, consider this. If your entire portfolio, every single property, every limited partnership, every shiny object you have spent the last decade acquiring was suddenly liquidated tomorrow to zero, what currency of life would you actually have left in your account to keep you solvent?